Welcome to the official podcast of No Poor Among Them, a project devoted to service and poverty reduction, where we aim to inspire and instruct in the art of service. We have a great program for you today. We're very excited to have Sarah Hall with us. Sarah was raised in Urbandale, Iowa. She left Iowa when she was 18 to attend Brigham Young University, where she received a BA in English and a minor in African Studies. After serving an LDS mission in South Africa and Botswana, Sarah continued her studies at BYU, where she received a Master of Public Administration with a nonprofit management emphasis. She has worked with NGOs in a variety of domains, including education, energy, childcare, and health. Her work has taken her to Ghana, Thailand, Mexico, Kenya, Tanzania. Sarah is currently a doctoral student in global health at Arizona State University. Sarah, welcome to No Poor Among Them.
Thank you.
To start out with, it seems like, from what I know of you, you've done a whole lot in your life to help those who are less fortunate. So where did this sort of mentality come from to help those who are less fortunate? And what was your progression from where you began to where you are now, and what kinds of learning opportunities have you had along the way?
Well, I think that my story is not that much different from the stories of other LDS humanitarian workers out there. I've always kind of had a thirst for traveling, and I've loved Africa ever since I was a little kid. I used to lay awake dreaming about studying lions or gorillas in the jungle. I even dressed up as Diane Fossey for career day in fifth grade, who is a zoologist who studied gorillas for 18 years in Rwanda. But I had never really considered humanitarian efforts in Africa. For me, it was all about adventure and wild animals when I was a kid. So when I was a freshman at BYU, I enrolled in a Swahili class. I think there were only four of us in the class. I got teased a lot for taking Swahili. My sister and some of my friends made fun of me, and they'd say things like, oh, you'll never use that, or you just want to be different. But I just felt like that was what I was supposed to do, so I didn't really pay too much attention. But when I decided to go on a mission, it ended up coming in handy. I got my call to South Africa, and I ended up training a sister from Tanzania. And when I got my call to South Africa, I was extremely excited. It was one of the most amazing moments of my life. I got to serve in South Africa for a year and Botswana for 6 months. It was also my first time out of the United States, and probably similar to many of the LDS people out there, it was my mission that ended up exposing me to the poverty and the injustices that led me to completely change my career path when I came back home. So my mission was hands down the hardest thing I had ever experienced. It was an unusually hard mission, not just because of the location, but due to some specific situations that happened there. At least five people I was teaching died while I was there, and then shortly after returning home, I was told about one of my companions' deaths. All of these people were young, and most, if not all of them, the illnesses or the deaths could have been preventable if only they had the resources that they needed to get access to medication or to certain medical procedures. The one situation that I probably remember most poignantly is when my companion, Sister Clore, and I got a phone call from a woman named Margaret. We'd been teaching her for about 6 months, along with her husband, Owen, and her daughter, Bukle, which means beautiful in Zulu. And she was from Zimbabwe, which had been pretty much politically destroyed, and they were immigrants there in South Africa. And they had braved all kinds of situations to get to South Africa. They were robbed by thugs, they crossed crocodile-infested rivers, and they were living in a little shack behind someone's house. When we got this phone call, it turned out that the night before, Owen had gotten a fever, and he had wanted to go to the hospital, but his wife, Margaret, had told him no because they didn't have money for a taxi to get there. So he left their bed, which was just a mattress on a dirt floor, and he went and he curled up in the dirt in a corner of the shack so that she could sleep better. And that night right there, he passed away. So when we arrived the next day, their 8-year-old daughter, Bufle, still didn't know anything about the situation. She found out what happened while we were there, and since the rest of the relatives were busy making arrangements, she came to us. So my companion and I were sitting there for over an hour holding this wailing 8-year-old girl in our arms, and it was probably the most heartbreaking thing I'd ever seen in my life. And the mother was just kind of laying on the mattress in the shack, completely despondent.
So this was a pivotal moment for me. It was pretty much the last straw. And I couldn't understand why God would allow something like that to happen to such good people like Margaret and Owen. But then I got to thinking about it, and I thought, well, it's not God that's making these things happen. Maybe it's people. Maybe it's due to these injustices in the world, and that these are preventable things, and that I can help prevent these things from happening to people. And it was at that point that I knew I couldn't really continue with the life trajectory that I had envisioned for myself. So when I got back to BYU, I changed my major, and I decided to do the MPA program. And this was all that I could go back to Africa one day and help people get better access to healthcare. So the mission is what I would say what really got me on that path.
Wow. Yeah, that would have to be a really sobering experience. You're currently a doctoral student at Arizona State University. And one of the things that you have been studying is problems surrounding people with albinism in Africa. Can you just give us an essence of what that problem is? And is there some sort of economic development problem that is tied to it?
Yeah, so albinism is an inherited condition, and it's a recessive genetic condition. It's caused by reduction or absence of pigmentation production, and the type of albinism that I'm talking about here is oculocutaneous albinism, or what's called OCA, and it affects the eyes, skin, and hair. So people with albinism of African descent usually have pale skin and yellowish hair. And OCA2 is the type of albinism that affects black Africans. And the prevalence in whites is about 1 in 37,000, but the prevalence in Tanzanians is 1 in 1,400. So it's much more prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa and particularly in Tanzania. And so people with albinism have a number of health issues, including poor vision and extreme sensitivity to the sun, which increases the likelihood of them getting skin cancers. And these health conditions kind of combined with other social conditions. Because of eye problems, albinos often can't see the blackboard at school, so many of them are undereducated and can't get good employment. But at the same time, because of skin sensitivity, many of them have problems finding employment outdoors. Or maybe they work outdoors anyway, but they end up getting skin cancer eventually. So as if these health problems weren't enough, there are some very disturbing beliefs about albinos that exist in Tanzania. One of them is that albinos are ghosts. So they can't die, they just disappear. Another one is that the mother must have had an albino from sleeping with a European man. So sometimes the fathers get really angry about that. Also, albinos are often thought to be a curse. So if there's a natural disaster in the area, or if the crops are failing, or if there's a drought, then people in the community sometimes think that this is caused because there is an albino in the area. And these myths make life very difficult for albino children. While I was in Tanzania this summer, I was able to interview about 12 albinos. And in most of the cases, the father had left the family because he blames the albino child on the mother. Sometimes the children were neglected by both parents. In one case, this albino lady's mother would never take her to the doctor and would never take her out to community events, but she would take her black siblings. Oftentimes, the family or the child is shunned by the community. One girl told me about how her classmates threw things at her when she walked close to the blackboard so she could see, and an albino man told me about how his classmates used to beat him several times a week and how they were never punished by the teacher. So as if all of those things weren't enough, some witch doctors are also perpetuating these myths. So when people come to the witch doctor, they want to be rich or successful. And the witch doctor will demand payment for a body part of an albino that is said to make them successful or rich. Then the witch doctor will go find and brainwash people to kill an albino for the customer. And there's a belief that if they cut off the limbs while the albino is still living, they are more powerful. Internal organs are also considered to be valuable, At least 64 albinos are known to have been murdered in Tanzania alone, but this number is probably more like hundreds. And one particular day, I was walking down the streets in Tanzania, and I ran into an albino friend of mine named Martha. She seemed like she was in a hurry, and I asked her where she was going. She told me that she was going to the morgue because she wanted to claim a murdered albino for burial. She invited me to come along with her, but I declined because, frankly, I didn't really feel like I had the stomach for it. But I don't believe the meeting was an accident because she really needed some money to be able to transport the body back, and I was able to help out a little bit there. But I did go to a press conference that she held later that day where they had discussed the murder. They also had a picture, and all the limbs had been severed. So it was a pretty sobering experience, and it was really exposing me to all of the horrors and the health issues and the social issues that are faced by albinos. You also asked about if this is tied to economic development, and I think that's true. The albinos that I spoke with often told me how hard it was for them to be employed, either because of discrimination or because they were working in the sun. And they also talked about how they don't have capital and that they're not educated. One man mentioned that even if he wanted to start his own business, he didn't think that people would buy from him because he would discriminate against his products and think that his products were bad. I also believe that the people who are convinced to commit murders are willing to believe those myths, probably because they are extremely poor, so they can be convinced that they're not really killing a person, they're just killing a ghost, and that albinos don't really die. I don't really see any other reason that people could be convinced to do something like that for, I don't know, 20 or 30 U.S. dollars.
Yeah. Oh, that's just... That, you know, Sarah, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on. A lot of these issues that you'll be talking about today are things that I know very little about, and I would assume that, our listeners would know very little about. So is there anything that someone like me or our listeners can do to help stop this?
I would say that educating yourself on the issue might be a start. There's a few documentaries out there that talk about the issues, and there's also news clips that you can find. And maybe just talking to your friends about it, maybe trying to raise some awareness. Also contributing to some of these nonprofit organizations that are out there to help albinos, I think, is another way that people can help out.
Okay. And do you know any of those by name, things that we could link to on this website?
Sure. There's one called Albino Peacemaker Group, and it was started by Martha, that albino woman that I was talking about. She's really great. She's albino herself, and she goes out and visits albinos, and she educates them on skin cancer and helps them get to the hospital. There's actually free treatment at a hospital in Moshi, Tanzania, but a lot of the albinos can't get there because they don't have transportation money. So helping her out, I think, would be good. And you could contact me if you wanted to do something like that because she doesn't have a computer or internet skills. There's another organization called Under the Same Sun that's doing some great things, and they do have a website.
Okay, great. So you also do work or have done work with malaria. So what exactly is malaria and how is it treated? It seems like right now, especially in the world, I think like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have, given a lot of money to rid the world of malaria right now. So why malaria and why now? And have you encountered the devastation of the disease firsthand? And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure thing. I'll start with the first question about what malaria is and how it's treated. So malaria is caused by parasites, and it's transmitted through mosquitoes. So these parasites basically go and set up camp in your liver where they multiply, and then they burst out. There's four different species of parasites, and the most dangerous of these is Plasmodium falciparum, which is the kind that you'll typically find in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. There's also a number of medications out there to combat it, although parasite resistance has been an ongoing problem. There's now combination-based therapy, and that's the recommended treatment in Tanzania, but many pharmacies, especially in rural areas, have outdated, ineffective, or counterfeit medicines. So that's a problem for the people. So what I've been studying is the issues surrounding malaria diagnosis and treatment, and it's actually a lot more complex than I originally thought. So just getting microscopes or medication or bed nets out there really isn't enough. It really isn't doing it enough. And community education efforts also isn't doing enough. And as far as why malaria and why now, the World Health Organization estimates that malaria causes over 500,000 deaths worldwide every year, and most of these are in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think because of the sheer number of children who are dying of malaria every year, that is the reason that I assume that combating malaria has been added to one of the Millennium Development Goals. There's 8 goals, and one of these explicitly states we want to combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. So I feel like there's a lot of funding allocated to it recently, and therefore there's a lot of attention dedicated to it. Although I do think it's interesting, in Tanzania, for example, pneumonia kills about the same number of kids as malaria does, but pneumonia seems to receive very, very little attention. So I would think that the malaria issue would be strongly linked to that Millennium Development Goal.
Interesting. Okay, so here's just a general question for you. In your service, you've met some amazing people along the way. Can you tell us about some of those people and how they've influenced your life?
Sure thing. I have met so many inspiring figures. I wish I could name them all. But I'll keep it short, and I'll talk about one woman named Mariamu Stafford. She's actually an albino woman that I met in Tanzania, and we're the same age, so I kind of felt a connection there from the beginning. So what happened to her is that she had both of her arms cut off in her home one day, and she survived this event, but she was in the hospital for 4 months. And, of course, it was difficult for her to be employed or do anything since she just had stumps for arms. But eventually she was sponsored and she was sent to America to receive some prosthetic limbs, and these limbs have hooks on the end. So the most impressive thing about her to me was her optimism and her determination. She was sent into the care of a nonprofit organization called Under the Same Sun, one of the ones that I previously mentioned, and she was sent to school to learn how to knit. And what's impressive to me is that she's so excited about knitting. She wants to work and she wants to support herself and her son. When I was talking to her about her attacker, she told me that she forgives him. She says, "It's over, I forgive him." And she said, "When the man goes to heaven, he will be forgiven. And I thank God so much for everything he's done for me." And to me, that was just a great lesson. I couldn't believe that she wasn't bitter. I couldn't believe she wasn't living in fear. She was just focusing on the blessing she had. She was working hard, thanking God for the opportunity that she had to work, for the opportunity that she had to have a son, and just for the joy that she could find in her life.
Wow, that's... I don't have problems compared to that, I think. Wow. Okay, all right, so just a final question for you here, Sarah. Why do you do what you do? And, okay, I guess 2 questions in one. So why do you do what you do? And if you could urge listeners to do one thing, what would it be?
I do what I do, I think, because I can. I feel like I can't solve everything. I can't save the world. I can't solve all the world's problems. But I feel like I can do something. I can help one person at a time. I can learn myself. I can help bring awareness to these issues so that others can join in and that they can help me and we can all join in together to help eliminate some of these injustices in the world. And if I could advise the listeners to do one thing, I think it would be, honestly, to lift where you stand. I think that there are people in need everywhere in our own backyards. We don't have to travel to a foreign country to find somebody to serve. I found in my personal life that if I sincerely pray for opportunities to serve and if I actually put myself out there, it's not hard to find opportunities to serve. And there are plenty of people out there that need a shoulder to cry on, that just need to talk, maybe just need to hear a compliment, maybe need to get a smile. There's also plenty of community service activities out there in the United States. There's food banks, there's rest homes. I think educating yourself on some of those issues out there in the world and being willing to talk about them and maybe contribute to an organization that's combating that if you're financially able, I think that's another thing that we can easily do from here. So that was actually definitely more than one thing, but mostly I would just say being willing to listen to people, to sincerely care about them, and to show Christ-like love.
Okay, that was a great answer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, well, Sarah Hall, we appreciate you sharing your experiences with us today on No Poor Among Them.
Thank you so much, Dave.